I may not have a license to kill, but liberalism dies a little every time I pull the trigger on it. This is a conservative's perspective. Hey everybody, James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective. I'm back. Well, I'm here at any rate, at least for today. It is the 31st of March. And it's time for ACP's year-end review. I know, man. I know. I've been doing this year-end review since I think December 29th, and here we are. And you know what? I just quit. I just stopped. I laid down. It was good. I liked it. I enjoyed it. Didn't do a whole lot. Then I decided to get back after it sometime in late January, and that didn't go anywhere. So I took February off to think it over, and here I am. One of the things, honestly, that's kept me from doing it is I can't keep up. Every daggone day, it's something, man. And you know, Bannon talks about flooding the zone, which is exactly what the strategy has been here over since January 20th. The Democrats and the left and the communists have no time to react to anything. Zero. You know what I mean? By the time their hair catches on fire, and by the time they put it out, the news cycle's moved on to something else. They don't have time to collate their thoughts. They don't have time to look back and try and assess what's just happened. They got to keep pushing forward. In a lot of ways, it's been the same thing with me. It's like, well, you know, what do I talk about? And it's like, well, shit, everything that's been going on, you know, you just can't hardly keep up. But we're going to try. And like I said, I may not be back, but I'm here. First thing in the year-end review, and I've summed this up, thought it over too. The first half of 2024, lawfare. First 6 months, 2024, lawfare. Jack White, Letitia James, Alvin Bragg, and that chick down in Atlanta, Faniqua Willis. All right, and that's all it was. And recap, all those people defeated. Boom, that was it. It was over. It wasn't going anywhere anyway. Lawfare, you know, is a delaying tactic. It's an obfuscating tactic. It's a dishonest tactic. And basically, you know, you throw enough crap on the wall, something's bound to stick. However, that being the case, nothing stuck. They want to act like it did. They want to make noises like it will one day. Nothing stuck. Nothing's going to stick. It's over. So that was the first half of 2024. A number of things happened in the second half of the year 2024. And I think one of the most critical things that happened in terms of significance, because there were a lot of significant things that went on in the last 6 months of 2024 with the campaign, with the election. And the most significant indicator that the light at the end of the tunnel wasn't simply just an oncoming train came in June of 2024 with this.
What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America, billionaires in America. And what's happening? They're in a situation where they, in fact, pay 8.2% in taxes. If they just paid 24%, 25%, either one of those numbers, they'd raise $500 million, billion dollars, I should say, in a 10-year period. We'd be able to wipe out his debt. We'd be able to help make sure that all those things we need to do, child care, elder care, making sure that we continue to strengthen our health care system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump?
Well, he's right. He did beat Medicare. He beat it to death, and he's destroying Medicare.
I remember sitting here in front of the TV last summer in June watching the debate, and I remember the first, you know, that the first, oh my gosh, the first question that Joe Biden answered, the entire country knew that the jig was up, that there was no way they could lie about it, there was no way they could whitewash it, there was no way they could camouflage it, sweep it away, redirect from what, you know, we'd been saying for the last 6 years, that Joe was out to lunch, that he was cognitively impaired. And that's being generous. Cognitively impaired. And it went on. And from that point on, the powers that be in the Democrat Party knew there was no way they could haul him through another election. It just wasn't going to happen. So Joe steps down. And that brings us to this.
Culture is, it is a reflection of our moment and our time, right? And present culture is the way we express how we're feeling about the moment. And we should always find times to express how we feel about the moment that is a reflection of joy, because it comes in the morning.
I asked my team actually to do I love Venn diagrams. Let me just tell you, I really just love Venn diagrams. So I asked them to do a Venn diagram for me.
Who doesn't love a yellow school bus, right? Can you raise your hand if you love a yellow school bus, right? Just, there's something about the, and most of us, many of us went to school on the yellow school bus, right? And it's part of our experience growing up.
Now, of course, that wasn't a speech. That was a montage. But it could have been. She made a lot of speeches that sounded pretty much like that. But no, that was a montage. And then Butler, Pennsylvania. And the return to Butler, Pennsylvania. And the convention. And the election. So we wrapped that up in about 8 minutes. That's not too bad. Not exactly what I thought I was going to be doing. But, and you know, and to try and catch up with what's going on since then, what I would say is, to me, it has been like every day is Friday. Every day is Christmas. Every day something good happens. Every day some left-wing kook is blowing his lid, flipping his wig over something that the Trump administration that is doing that is long overdue, obviously. Things that are long overdue. They're taking care of business. They're looking good doing it. And it's kind of weird because it's almost like, I don't want to say since the debate, but beginning with that time frame, all the things we have speculated upon that the Democrats have done, all the dirty, crooked, corrupt, immoral, evil, egregious, heinous acts that they've committed, that we've suspected them of committing, turns out to be true. It all turns out to be true. And it's not surprising. I mean, in terms of validation, yeah, it's great. It makes you feel good, because we've been talking about this stuff for years with Joe Biden. Okay, and let's just take one thing. Let's just take the cognitive decline, and let's just take it from the 2020 campaign up till now. We have been told time and time and time and time again, nothing wrong with the dude. Like I've said, he's the greatest political mind since James Madison, since Winston Churchill, and there's nothing wrong with this cat. His mind is like a steel trap. Everything, you know, every time he thinks of something, his neck jumps up and swallows his head. It's unbelievable the amount of massive presidential brain tissue we have up there in the bucket. And we know it's not true. We know it's not true. Has he been anywhere? Speaking of which, January 20th, Joe split Tim. Has he been anywhere? I know that he picked up some representation for an agent, like for, you know, press agent, or not press agent, but a booking agent, you know, somebody for, because I'm sure they're lining up to have Joe speak at dinner functions and everything else. So he's with some kind of big Hollywood agency out there in Hollywood, and way out there in Hollywood where all the Hollywood people do Hollywood stuff. And I tell you what, man, Hollywood is a weird town. Always has been. Shouldn't be surprised by that. But beyond those things, we don't see Joe anywhere. Don't see Kamala anywhere. Tim Walz has come out like an idiot. And just in case he thought there might have been people who doubted that he was an idiot during the campaign, he's been on a reestablishment of that fact tour. And everybody else is taking a powder. You don't see Kamala. You don't see Joe. Why would we? Why would we? Honestly. And now, like I said, the people are starting to fall into line. President Trump has known, as we've all known, the purse strings are where you get results. Tariffs. Okay, these people, you know, it's a reciprocity. What does that mean? Well, that means that he's going to charge the same amount on our tariffs that countries charge us for our products. That's what that means. It's not going to hurt anybody. There may be, and he has even said, he even admitted himself, there might be an initial period of discomfort as these things come into place, but more often than not, rather than these tariffs taking place, these countries are submitting. They're dropping their tariffs, or they're bringing their tariffs on par with what we charge them. There's no, you know, massive, heavy one-sidedness to it. And those places like Canada that are still trying to do this, I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's a bad idea because, you know, by the end of the summer, when their money is valued at 25% of what ours is, when they see a devaluation of over 75%, they're going to be hurting. They're going to be hurting bad. And you know what? Here's the thing. Canadians are good people. Yeah, I know they're talking all kind of shit right now, and I get that. And that's because they're being ginned up by their government to do this. That's all that is. That's all that is. And but Canadians are good people. I've talked to a lot of them, and they've all been pleasant. They've all been very personable, you know, enjoyable people. I've enjoyed the time I've spent talking with them, hanging around. Not a whole lot, you know, but everybody that I've met from Canada has been remarkably polite and a very, very nice person. William Shatner's from Canada, you know. So there, that's all I'm going to say about that. So the tariffs are going to work, and they're going to work one of two ways. They're going to work by being used, by being implemented, and, you know, within a couple of months, within at least maybe one business quarter, these people that are going to wind up paying this stuff are going to be screaming bloody murder. They're going to be crying uncle. Or they're going to go ahead and assess that threat correctly before they're implemented. They're going to read the writing on the wall. And what they're going to do is they're going to work with the Trump administration to make sure that that doesn't happen, that they don't get popped with those tariffs. Good move. Good move. And I can't remember who it was. It was somebody I heard on Oh, I heard him on SiriusXM. Anyway, I want to say it was Pete Navarro. It might have been Pete Navarro. It might not have. It might have been Howard Lutnick. It was one of the financial guys. And when they were talking about these tariffs, and the countries of the world sat up straight and they clutched at their pearls, and they were shocked and appalled that the United States would ever do anything like this. By God, we're Europe. You've been handing out to us since the Second World War. And what do you mean you're going to stop? Or you're going to enact reciprocal tariffs? We're going to go into a period of reciprocity. So anyway, it was Lutnick. It may have been Navarro. It was one of those guys. And they said... And I've known this all along because you guys have heard me say it here on the program much more than once. Donald Trump is probably, and they said, I think, the greatest intuitive negotiator. And I always said that he was probably the greatest intuitively gifted psychologist, psychiatrist. But, you know, negotiator's probably better. A successful negotiator is going to know what motivates the person he's going to be negotiating against. He knows what makes him tick. He knows what motivates him. And he will use those things. He will use that knowledge and that ability to divine that knowledge and work out a deal that's going to be good for everybody. He's done it all his life. And that's what's happening here. Like I said, there are going to be people that, you know, I can remember times in the neighborhood when I was a kid, you know, somebody would do something, one of those guys would do something stupid, and they would get lit up by their parents, okay? There would be a switch, there would be a belt, there would be something. And the old saying was, if you can't listen, you're going to have to feel. And that's what's going on here. The ones that won't listen are going to have to feel. The ones that will listen are going to be spared a lot of discomfort. And it's not going to hurt them nearly as much in the long run as it would to do what Canada's doing. Canada thinks they're going to be able to rely on the European Union. Canada wants to talk all kind of trash about Donald Trump, saying they could be the 51st state. And then... Castro's son, Trudeau, they're calling him Governor Trudeau. Well, look, here's the thing. When these tariffs against Canada, I'm speaking just about specifically Canada, were talked about, were speculated on, and Donald Trump was talking about using them early on, Justin Trudeau made a beeline to Mar-a-Lago, and tries to break down for President Trump the information that says, hey, you know what? If you do this, you're going to crush our economy. Our government will no longer be able to exist. Well, if that's the case, why are you guys getting so mad about becoming the 51st state? If you're so reliant on the money that's generated by the tariffs that you're imposing on we here in the United States, and a reciprocity of those tariffs would collapse your government, are you really a sovereign nation? Oh, no, he said that. Yeah, are they really a sovereign nation? Are they, you know, viable as a nation state? Well, obviously they're not. There's no way they can be. And the new guy, Bob or Doug McKenzie, I can't remember which. Oh, and the Ford guy, Doug Ford. And I may be speaking out to Ernie. It was either him or his brother. I think he had a brother. But one of them was big on smoking crack. He was like a political officer. And it was about 10, 12 years ago. And he got popped for smoking crack back during the Obama days, I think is what it was. Bob or Doug Ford, one of them. They may not even be related, but... The one that's talking now about hating America and ginning up all this disdain and hatred for America amongst the Canadian people, you know, it's going to cost them. And they think, because the prime minister, not the not Doug Ford or Bob Ford, whichever one it was. The prime minister there is thinking the European Union's going to come out. He's a big globalist dude, and they just put in another progressive. We'll see what happens. But I don't think it's going to work. I think that at some point, once Canada, and they'll probably be bitter about it in the end. Ultimately, they will be remarkably bitter about it. They'll submit to it. They'll go along with the plan, and ultimately it'll be the best thing for Canada's economy, especially if they're interested in remaining a sovereign nation. But ultimately, see, they'll come to see the error of their ways and the positive benefits of going along with the program here. Let's talk about NPR for a minute. National Public Radio. Basically, it has been a taxpayer-funded, weaponized arm of the left since its inception. And in the interest of disclosure, I used to listen to a lot of National Public Radio, especially on the weekends. There was a couple of different shows, Car Talk, one of them. And the other one was a show called What Do You Know? It was a game show. And then late at night, in my 30s, now in the 30s I did this. And I'm not talking about the 1930s. I'm talking about my 30s in the 19s. Anyway, they did a lot of ambient music, if you know what I'm talking about. You can find it on YouTube now. As an old person, I listen to it to fall asleep to. You know, solfeggio tones, that sort of thing. Ambient music. They had some great shows. One of them was called Nightshades. Came on about 11 o'clock. And invariably, I would catch a buzz and listen to those guys. But then I just stopped listening because it was dull. NPR's dull. All things considered, it's dull. But it is definitely a weaponized left-wing arm for the Democrats. And last week, a lady by the name of... this is what happened when you smoke all that weed in your 30s. You can't remember shit. Catherine Marr, I think, is this delightful child's name. She's the chief executive officer of National Public Radio. I'm pretty sure. Hang on a minute. Let me make sure. I'll make sure I got her name right, too. Yeah, I was right. Catherine Moore. And she was in somewhere doing something. I remember now. She was testifying in Congress before the... Department of Governmental Efficiency Committee, and they were talking with her. And if you don't know, NPR is about as left wing as you can get. If you haven't listened to them here in the last 12-16 years, just go check it out, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. But she's testifying, and what they're testifying is that the government money. Now, I think in terms of government funding, National Public Radio gets about 1%, maybe a little bit more, of their funding from the government. The rest of it comes from private businesses, from private concerns, like CBS, like ABC, like CNN. You know, they have an advertiser that pays, And National Public Radio takes that money and uses it to maintain its presence on the air in exchange for advertisements from these companies. So she's testifying, and the thing that is disturbing about all this, sorry, I didn't mean to hit the microphone there. The thing that's really disturbing is all 87, this was done, there was a guy named Berliner, Ira, I think, but anyway, he was a well-respected long-term journalist at National Public Radio, and he wrote an essay about what was going on. And this was last year. This was in 2024. He wrote this essay, and he pointed out that all 87, and there were 87 members of the National Public Radio editorial board, every one of them registered Democrats. Now, this isn't a surprise to me. I mean, it was news, but was it a surprise? No. And it's probably not a surprise to you either. It's probably not a surprise to anybody, like I said, that's listened to NPR in the last 30 years. And I was thinking about this. Jim Jordan really puts it on her. I've got the clip. We'll play it here in a minute. Matter of fact, let's go ahead and play that now while I try and coalesce what the hell I'm going to talk about next. This is from last week, Representative Jim Jordan on the Department of Governmental Efficiencies Committee, and they're talking with Catherine Marr, Chief Executive Officer, National Public Radio.
Business editor for NPR.
How long do you work at NPR?
I believe he was there just over 25 years.
25 years? Award-winning journalist? Did he win any awards?
Our time did
Peabody Award, that's pretty important, isn't it?
That is, absolutely.
A pretty distinguished journalist, right?
Certainly.
And he wrote a long story about what you do at NPR. Is NPR biased?
Congressman, I have never seen any instance of...
Never?
Political bias determining editorial decisions, no.
Well Ms. Mr. Berliner, in his story last year, wrote, I've, in the D.C. area, editorial positions at NPR... He said he found 87 registered Democrats, zero Republicans. Is that accurate?
We do not track the numbers or the voter registration, but I find that
concerning. Was an award-winning journalist who worked 25 years at NPR, Mr. Berliner, was he lying when he wrote that?
I am not presuming such. I just don't have, we don't track that information about our journalists.
87 to zero? And you're not biased?
I think that is concerning if those numbers are accurate.
It's concerned. I mean, it wasn't 44-43, it wasn't 60-27, it wasn't 70-17, it wasn't even 80-7. It was 87 Democrats, zero Republicans, and you say NPR is not biased. How about the big stories over the last few years? According to Mr. Berliner, again, he wrote on the Trump-Russia story, he wrote, at NPR, we hitched our wagon to Trump's most visible antagonist, Representative Adam Schiff. They said they interviewed him 25 times. Is that accurate?
I was not there at the time, but those numbers sound accurate. Yes.
Those sound accurate. But then he said when the Mueller report came out, and they said, Robert Mueller said he found no evidence of collusion. He said, Russiagate faded from our programming. Is that accurate?
Again, I was not there at the time. I couldn't say.
You couldn't say?
I was not at NPR at the time.
You didn't prepare for that? You knew we were going to ask you about this guy, didn't you? It's come up like 6,000 times already in the hearing.
I just couldn't say whether it faded from our coverage, sir.
How about this story? October 2020, the New York Post had the Hunter Biden laptop story, and one of those editors, I guess one of those 87 Democrat editors, said this, we don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories. We don't want to waste the listeners' and readers' times on stories that are just pure distractions. Was that a pure distraction story?
Our current editorial leadership believes that that was a mistake, as do I.
Yeah, the whole country knows that was a mistake. Definitely impacted the election, or I think it certainly impacted the election. How about the COVID origin story? That's a pretty big story too, right? Mr. Berliner said, we became fervent members of the team Natural Origin, even declaring that the lab leak was debunked by scientists. Turns out, though, the lab leak is what most people think actually caused the COVID virus.
Sorry, question there?
There is. You guys were 0-3 on the three of the biggest stories in the last 5 years. You guys were 0-3, and yet you maintain that NPR is not biased?
Congressman, I do not believe we are politically biased. No, we are a nonpartisan organization.
Nonpartisan organization.
Nonpartisan organization where every single member, all 87 members of the National Public Radio editorial board are registered Democrats. Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And to bring that point home even further, here's Representative Brandon Gill. Again, another 5 minute fusillade, but worth every second.
Thank you, Chairwoman Green, and I apologize. I'm getting over a cold. So I'm losing my voice here. Ms. Maher, I want to start with you. Just generally, would you say you generally agree or disagree with the following statement? The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles?
I would not say I agree with that, sir.
You're not. That's good to hear. It's interesting because a lot of your thinking, as expressed by your public statements, is deeply infused with economic and cultural Marxism. Do you believe that America is addicted to white supremacy?
I believe that I tweeted that, and as I've said earlier, I believe much of my thinking has evolved over the last half decade.
It has evolved. Why did you tweet that?
I don't recall the exact context, sir, so I wouldn't be able to say.
Okay. Do you believe that America believes in black plunder and white democracy?
I don't believe that, sir.
You tweeted that in reference to a book you were reading at the time, apparently, The Case for Reparations.
I don't think I've ever read that book, sir.
You tweeted about it. You said you took a day off to fully read The Case for Reparations. You put that on Twitter in January of 2020.
I apologize. I don't recall that I did.
Okay.
No doubt that your tweet there is correct, but I don't recall that.
Okay. Do you believe that white people inherently feel superior to other races?
I do not.
You don't? You tweeted something to that effect. You said, I grew up feeling superior. Ha, how white of me. Why did you tweet that?
I think I was probably reflecting on what it was to grow up in an environment where I had lots of advantages.
It sounds like you're saying that white people feel superior.
I don't believe that anybody feels that way, sir. I was just reflecting on my own experiences.
Do you think that white people should pay reparations?
I've never said that, sir.
Yes, you did. You said it in January of 2020. You tweeted, yes, the North, yes, all of us, yes, America, yes, our original collective sin and unpaid debt, yes, reparations, yes, on this day.
I don't believe that was a reference to fiscal reparations, sir.
What kind of reparations was it a reference to?
I think it was just a reference to the idea that we all owe much to the people who came before us.
That's a bizarre way to frame what you tweeted. Okay, how much reparations have you personally paid?
Sir, I don't believe that I've ever paid reparations.
Okay, just for everybody else.
I'm not asking anyone
to pay
reparations.
Seems to be what you're suggesting.
Sir.
Do you believe that looting is morally wrong?
I believe that looting is illegal, and I refer to it as counterproductive. I think it should be prosecuted.
Do you believe it's morally wrong, though?
Of course.
Of course. Then why did you refer to it as counterproductive? It's a very different way to describe it.
It is both morally wrong and counterproductive, as well as being
illegal.
You
tweeted, it's hard to be mad about protests in reference to the BLM protests, not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression. You didn't condemn the looting. You said that it was counterproductive. NPR also promoted a book called In Defense of Looting. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars?
I'm unfamiliar with that book, sir, and I don't believe that was at my time at NPR.
You tweeted that you read that book, but...
I don't believe that I did read that book, sir.
Do you think that a few years ago, NPR educated America about... quote, the whole community of genderqueer dinosaur enthusiasts. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of tax dollars?
I was not at NPR at the time, sir.
That's not the question, though. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of our tax dollars?
I think our tax dollars that we use are to be able to provide a wide range of
perspectives. I'll take that as a yes. You do believe that that's appropriate. Your health advisor at NPR also stated in an interview that, quote, fear of fatness is more harmful than actual fat. Would you like to explain how fear of fatness is more harmful than actual fat? That's an editorial at NPR.
I am not familiar with the editorial, and I don't believe that was published during my time here.
It's called Diet Culture is Everywhere. Here's how to fight it. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars?
I think any reporting on health is an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars, yes.
And you think that editorializing that fat is not unhealthy is appropriate?
I don't know what that article is, sir, and I'm not familiar with it,
this
so I couldn't say.
This is fake news. Do you think that basic accommodations like doorways or seatbelts represent, quote, latent fat phobia?
I don't have an opinion.
That's also from NPR. Do you think civility is racist?
No, sir.
No. Your outlet ran an article entitled, quote, When Civility is Used as a Cudgel Against People of Color. That was on All Things Considered. Would you like to explain?
I'm not on the editorial side, sir. I'm not familiar with that story.
You talk about how NPR is news. This is editorialization, and I'll read it. For many people of color in the United States, civility isn't so much social lubricant as it is a vehicle for containing them, preventing social mobility, and preserving the status quo. This is garbage. I'll spend all of my time doing everything I can to ensure you guys never get another dollar of taxpayer funding. This is complete garbage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You know, it's always the same with these cats. And by that, what I mean is when they come to testify, I noticed it probably more so with Dr. Fauci than anybody. He was, I guess, maybe like one of the first ones. and there are two ways that these cats go when they testify before Congress and something is on the line. And Fauci's a good example. Fauci went in and he was always arrogant no matter what they, you know, how many lies they caught him in, and they caught him in a boatload of them. And he would just use arrogance and bluff and bluster his way through. But again, nothing's probably ever going to happen to these people. Okay, the chick that was running, I can't even remember her name. She's so forgettable. She was running the Secret Service at the time when they first tried to kill President Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, Bucks County. They do like that, and they do like this chick does here. Or they do like Fauci, and they do like, what was that, Ronnie Rowe, was that his name? Ronnie Rowe, he took over after the first forgettable person, the woman I was just talking about, Suzanne somebody. All right, he's gone, you know, and he went in, and he was arrogant, and he was, oh, the men and the women of the Secret Service, the greatest men and women in the world. And you know what? They probably are, except for the DIE hires. And I'm not saying that they're not bad people. I'm just saying that they're probably remarkably ineffective and incompetent at their job, as we saw that day in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, last summer. So they go in quiet, and they go in, you know, totally unaware of it. You're in charge. You are the chief executive officer. And you had no idea that all 87 members of the editorial board were Democrats. Card-carrying, dues-paying donors, okay? Democrat donors, most likely. No idea. But even if they are, to an individual, all 87 of them registered Democrats, they're still, you know, we can trust them to be objective, fair, and partisan in their editorial comments. They're all damn Democrats, for the love of God, man. Okay? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So she goes out, she testifies, and I don't know that, like I said, 1% of their funding comes from the government, something like that. I think it's like 1%, and you know, and they're fighting tooth and nail to keep it. not dead air. I'm just here collating things. And, you know, and all these people, and I know a lot of National Public Radio listeners. Like I said, I was once upon a time, 30-some-odd years ago, I was one myself. And I've told my epiphany story more than once. I'm not going to do it now, but I think it's been attributed to Winston Churchill. And he said, bleh. No. He said, wait a minute, now I can't remember what he said. Oh, yes, this is a saying that's been attributed to him. And it is, when you are young and you're a conservative, you have no heart. But if you're old and you're a liberal, you have no brain. And we've all heard the saw, you know, what is a conservative? A conservative is nothing more than a liberal who got mugged. And that's not, I won't argue that either. But these people, and this is I'm digressing, but you know what? It's my show. I can do that shit. And like I said, I was just watching these guys as they testify. And the heads of these agencies who are in a panic, and believe me, they are all in a panic, okay? We're going to talk about the United States Institute for Peace here in a little bit and what was happening with those guys. That's just unreal. That's just unfreaking believable. But anyway, they have been so used, comfortable, embedded, secure in the knowledge that everything they were doing, they could continue to do. And the money was just going to keep flowing. And I can understand completely why they would think that, because up until this point, that's how it's been. Oh, the public would find out about the $500 toilet seat from the Pentagon, or the boondoggles that we all know happen in a government once it gets big enough. Excuse me. I'm going to hit the pause button. I'm feeling the need to expectorate. Be right back. And we're back, sounding a little bit better. But the point I'm making is these guys, they either try to play it cool or they try to just brush it off with arrogance and confidence. But they don't know what else to do. This has never happened to them before. Now, I'm not talking about Ronnie Rowe or those people. I mean, but there was heat there. And we got to see firsthand through the original director of the CIA, Jill Biden's pal. And then, you know, she testified and then 3 days later resigned or retired again. And Ronnie Rowe, this guy Ronald Rowe took in, and he was central casting, man. I mean, he looked as about Secret Service as you could get, and he was very defensive, at the same time stonewalling and arrogant. And then this lady here, you know, she's kind of arrogant in a very, very subdued way, but they all do the same thing. They obfuscate, they blow smoke, they backpedal, and when they can't do that, they act shocked and appalled that these things are happening, or that people would believe that they were happening. The simple fact of the matter, I think, is this, and one of the reasons that these people act so confident is not because of the percentage of money that the government funds National Public Radio, although there is that, and I'm sure even 1% if that's accurate, is a pretty chubby chunk of change. It works out well because the people, the private individuals and the businesses that make donations to National Public Radio, that's ad time. Okay, they may not be running a commercial, but funding for the McNeil Lehrer Hour is brought to you in part by General Motors or, you know, something like that. Well, okay, so that means that the liberals that are listening to this drivel are going to look kindly upon General Motors because General Motors doesn't fund these guys. And General Motors is funding these guys because the government is still tied to it. Again, it's not how much the government pays. It's that the government pays at all. And if something were to happen and the government needed to pony up more money for National Public Radio, there were enough Democrats around in the past where they could get it. And it was all good. Everything was great. If the federal funding were cut to National Public Radio, and let's go ahead and throw in public broadcasting. No more federal funding. The funding that National Public Radio or public broadcasting got would come from private individuals, private donors, and corporations. I think because of the absence of the United States federal government, National Public Radio wouldn't last a year, maybe two. You guys remember Air America? Who remembers Air America? Randy Rhodes and Janine Garofalo. It was an anti, but it was back during the George W. Bush years and the 9/11 war, the second Gulf War. And it was set up, it was a private enterprise, and it was set up as a counter to what has always been a runaway popular market, and that is conservative talk radio, AM talk radio. And it was supposed to run as a counter to that because reasons, I can't remember, you know, what. But anyway, so they did, and it lasted about a year. And it was like almost from the very beginning, from the first day they went on the air, they started, you know, losing stations. It was terrible. It was just terrible. And in the meantime, people like Rush Limbaugh, like Hannity, like Michael Savage, like I'm trying to think some of the other popular guys at that time, Ian Punnett, Rusty Humphries, these dudes that were tearing up the turn of the century, the early 2000s. All because of Rush, obviously, all because of Rush, but because that genre is popular throughout the country and it resonates to this day. That's me pounding on my desk. It resonates with the American people in a way that National Public Radio and public broadcasting in Air America never, ever, ever in their wildest dreams ever could. They don't need public funding. I mean, they don't need government funding. They don't need taxpayer funding. If what they're saying is that important, if what they're saying needs to be taken that seriously and is taken that seriously, that people want that, they'll pay for it. They'll be able to exist in the private market. People wanted to listen to Rush Limbaugh. People still want to listen to him. God, I miss that guy. People want to listen to Andrew Wilkow. People want to listen to David Webb. People want to listen to Mark Levin. One or two of them, actually, after, believe it or not, want to listen to me. Go figure. Obviously, it's a sleep issue that they're having. But I don't know that they could. I just don't think they would survive because it's just too extreme. It's too extreme for relevance. It's just crazy. And you heard some of the stuff they were talking about there. I mean, these are the people. People listen to public radio believe, like Pete Buttigieg, that Rhodes can be racist, man. Rhodes can be racist. Goddamn Rhodes. Sons of bitches. Anyway. Will they lose their funding? Probably not. I don't know if they will or not. They've been embarrassed. They don't need it. It's 1%. If they fold over the loss of 1% of their funding, if that's the case, I think that's what it is. I believe that's what I read in the article. Could be wrong. Check it out. But anyway, they're overwhelmingly sponsored by corporations. Just like any program on any AM or FM radio, or on satellite radio for that matter. Not dead air, man. I'm just thinking about it. We'll see what happens. We'll just have to see what happens with this. Not really much of a place to stop, but we're going to go ahead and stop here. I want to play something for you. This is, it's old. It's one of Donald Trump's monologues from the first campaign. It's called The Best Is Yet to Come. I've always been a fan of it since the first time I heard it. And every now and then I like to play it to kind of pep us up. Dig this. It's probably been a while since you heard it, but it's no less true today than it was then.
America is a land of heroes, a place where greatness is born, where destinies are forged, and where legends come to life. This is the home of Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt, of many great generals, including Washington, Pershing, Patton, and MacArthur. This is the home of Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Tubman, the Wright brothers, Neil Armstrong, and so many more. This is the country where children learn names like Wyatt Earp, Davy Crockett, and Annie Oakley. This is the place where the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, and where Texas Patriots made their last stand at the Alamo. The American nation was carved out of the vast frontier by the toughest, strongest, fiercest, and most determined men and women ever to walk on the face of the earth. Our ancestors braved the unknown, tamed the wilderness, settled the Wild West, lifted millions from poverty, disease, and hunger, vanquished tyranny and fascism, ushered the world to new heights of science and medicine, laid down the railroads, dug out the canals, raised up the skyscrapers. Our ancestors built the most exceptional republic ever to exist in all of human history. And we are making it greater than ever before. This is our glorious and magnificent inheritance. We are Americans. We are pioneers. We are the pathfinders. We settled the new world. We built the modern world. And we changed history forever by embracing the eternal truth that everyone is made equal by the hand of Almighty God. America is the place where anything can happen. America is the place where anyone can rise. And here, on this land, on this soil, on this continent, the most incredible dreams come true. This nation is our canvas, and this country is our masterpiece. We look at tomorrow and see unlimited frontiers just waiting to be explored. Our brightest discoveries are not yet known. Our most thrilling stories are not yet told. Our grandest journeys are not yet made. The American age, the American epic, the American adventure has only just begun. Our spirit is still young. The sun is still rising. God's grace is still shining. And my fellow Americans, the best is yet to come.
First time I heard it, I thought it was awesome, and I've played it many, many times since. You know, one of the reasons I haven't done a show, honestly, is that, and again, they flooded the zone. There's so many things happening all at once, all over the place. Excuse me. That this is difficult to pick out a place to start. But I realize now that this is definitely not the time to sit back and rest on laurels or bask in the afterglow. These people are still conducting lawfare just like they did. They're not going to stop. They don't know anything else. That's why you have these judges, these treasonous judges. James Boasberg, one of the worst, that's trying to do this stuff. We have to maintain our vigilance. We have to maintain awareness. We have to make sure everybody knows what these people are doing at all times. And as soon as we find out, we've got to start spreading the word. And that's kind of like what I do. I find out on the stuff that really gets on me, and share it with you. And I really don't. And this is all the time we've got for now. I'm on spring break. And I'm digging it. And I'm excited. Is it Tuesday already? I don't know. Man, I'm not sure. Is it maybe it is. Maybe it's not. I think it is. I think it is Tuesday. Because I started doing laundry and stuff yesterday, which would have been Monday. So thank you for the opportunity of exercising, to get to speak with you. I appreciate you exercising a little bit of patience, a little bit of indulgence in tuning in. Thank you once again. ACP is usually, I'm trying to get back to it. I've been saying that for a while, man, and I'm sorry. Sunday afternoons, usually by 4 p.m., the show is posted on its various platforms, and you can find it then and there. Thank you for the opportunity of getting to share some of this stuff with you. We're on Facebook doing stuff here and there. You can find me there. You want to send some brickbats to me, James Bostic, Facebook. Again, thanks for the opportunity. I know this was a little rough and rusty, but we're getting back into it. And next week we'll be a little more eloquent, a little more coherent. Anyway, that's all the time we got for today. We'll be here again next week, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. You guys take good care of yourselves. We'll see you then.